The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The plight of migrants traveling from war in Syria and political and economic oppression in North and West Africa is now a global crisis. The Obama administration has vowed to accept at least 10,000 displaced Syrian refugees, but immigration is a red meat issue among America's presidential candidates. From insults against Mexican nationals to the ethnicity of anchor babies, the topic stirs up both the liberal and conservative base. While most Americans may consider people fleeing mortal danger to be welcomed and treated differently than economic immigrants caught crossing the border, their fates may not be all that dissimilar. Asylum seekers can spend months, even years, inside of hundreds of detention centers spread across the United States. Tom Peters is a journalist. He's currently based in Turkey, and we found his article, They Treat You Like an Inmate, at Politico.com. Hello, Tom.
Thank you so much for having me here.
I'm sure this is quite complicated, but if you can summarize what U.S. policy is on granting political asylum.
So asylum, it's similar in many places. You cannot plead asylum unless you are physically in the U.S., and that's also the case with Europe as well. That's why we see the Syrians and other folks going there by boat and all this stuff. But so you need to actually get yourself to a border crossing or into the country somehow. So in the U.S., that means you have two options. You could arrive on, say, a tourist visa, and once you get to the airport, you could ask for asylum. Generally speaking, if you're an asylum seeker, you're probably not going to have some sort of legal visa. You're going to probably arrive on a land border. And that doesn't mean that you're crossing illegally. You would just go to the port of entry, like the Bridge of the Americas that connects Ciudad Juarez and El Paso, Texas. And you would get to the customs point, and you would tell the officials that you're pleading asylum.
How do they establish this danger? Is it by country or case by case?
Well, it's case by case. So if you arrive, let's say that you're coming from Mexico, and you would say that you have credible fear. Let's say that you're being threatened by not only the drug cartel but the Mexican military and police. And so what they would do is they would put you into a temporary holding facility. And this is where it can kind of get into some gray area, because these holding facilities could be anything from a kind of like an open dorm. So you would either go to that, or you could be potentially taken to a local jail if that's over full. And now, on average, you would spend about 19 days in one of these facilities. And you would have an interview with DHS or CBP officials to establish what they call a credible fear. So they would do an interview with you, look at your identity, make sure that it's correct, and then try to make sure that your story is indeed accurate. And most U.S. officials will tell you they do. It's pretty easy for them to weed out fake claims from legitimate claims.
Tom, your article opens with a pretty dark story of two men in Mexico, blindfolded, expecting to die, but they manage to get out of it and make their way to the border. How commonly do stories of asylum seekers begin like this?
So these two men that I talked to in the story, Israel and Efrain Chavez, and they had been brought to the U.S. as children. They were caught in an ICE sweep in their mid to late 20s. And taken back over into to Mexico. The vast majority of their family, whom they had close ties to, was still in the U.S. But they were living in this house in Juarez. One of their their cousins down there got into trouble with the Mexican authorities, and they were taken out into the desert, and they watched as men who they believed were Mexican law enforcement officials beat their cousin to death. And they were told that if they told anyone about what had happened, that they should say that their cousin was abducted by aliens. And they made it very clear that if Israel and Efron were to say otherwise, that they would face a similar fate. So once that happened to them, they just immediately got into their car and drove to the nearest border crossing. I would say the vast majority of asylum seeker stories you hear have usually a very horrific bent to them. Experience with the drug cartels and drug violence and those sorts of things. And that's pretty common if you're going to talk about people from Mexico. But we also have people that come in over our land borders who travel from places like Somalia or, anywhere in the world where there's instability. And if you're coming from a place like Somalia or any war-torn region, it would be rare for you to make that journey without having experienced some serious and usually very graphic and difficult experience. You're not going to the expense and the danger and all of that is it's not going to be something you take on casually.
You mentioned these credible fear tests. Well, only 5% of those who pass the test receive asylum or other relief. So what happens to those who don't receive asylum?
Well, so and this is where you get into some real, real hardship stories. So the gentleman that I opened this Politico story with, they'd had this horrific experience of seeing their family member, beaten to death in front of them. This was about 2 years ago that this happened, and one of them has managed to get out, but it's not because of, credible fear or anything. He had a marriage to an American citizen, and that was what got him out, but it took 11 months. Now, the other one, Efrain Chavez, he is still in this holding facility, and he's had his bid for asylum was initially rejected. He has an attorney that he's working with, and now he's gone through the appeals process, but it's like any legal proceeding. Once you get into appeals and these sorts of things, it can take quite a bit of time. But unlike your average legal proceeding, you're held in a detention facility.
That's 2 years in a detention facility. Who's paying for that?
Well, the U.S. taxpayers are, to a tune of on average of $161 a day. And there's some facilities where the per person fee can go up to almost $300. So it's really quite costly, and not just in terms of the financial expense, but what it does to the people who are pleading asylum. If you have an attorney who's helping you with your asylum case, you are 4 to 6 times more likely to get asylum than someone who doesn't. And yet, only about 15% of asylum seekers have access to an attorney. There's alternatives to detention. You could put an ankle monitoring bracelet, like someone who is on probation might have. Or there's systems where people could do checks or phone calls. There's a number of alternatives. It costs anywhere from less than $1 to about $17 a day. And in pilot studies that the U.S. government has done, the main objective here is to get these folks to show up to court hearings. To determine their immigration status, and in the cases where they've tried these alternatives to detentions, they've been over 99% effective in getting people to show up to court. So, it's the current system that we have is costly, and it's questionable as to whether or not it really merits that cost.
We're talking about the thousands of migrants who are seeking asylum here in the United States. Tom Peter is with us. He wrote about both the cost and the conditions of facilities housing asylum seekers for Politico. How many people are we talking about held in these detention centers?
Well, now the one thing you have to make the distinction is with a lot of these figures, the asylum seekers are mixed into the detention facilities with other immigrants. So this could also be, they'd be in there with someone who crossed the border illegally, uh-huh. who was an economic migrant. But of asylum seekers, we're talking about annually probably about 15,000.
Okay, and you mentioned that there are hundreds of these facilities throughout the U.S. Do we know that they're among us?
I don't think most people do. It's we spend about $2 billion a year detaining immigrants, and included in that is asylum seekers. And it's a massive cost, and there are these detention facilities that are out kind of in the middle of nowhere in most cases, in these small towns, and really in a lot of these little towns, the detention facility is probably the main industry or the main driver of the economy.
Well, or immigrants. I mean, I can't imagine that somebody making their way to the United States, if they knew that this was the process to get legal asylum, you know, would they be persuaded to try and go illegally and do it otherwise?
Well, you know, certainly the benefit of doing it this way, where you would show up at a border and plead asylum legally, is that, you know, if you come over illegally, it creates a host of other issues for you. So if for the folks that do try crossing legally, they have a better shot at potentially getting settled here. But I mean, we're still talking 5% of people that pass the test, and people don't really know what they're getting into. You know, another person I talked to for this story. Traveled from Somalia, and they went from all the way from Somalia to Brazil. And when she got to Brazil, the smugglers had told her that Brazil was like about a 20-minute drive from the U.S. border. Mm. And she'd only heard of Brazil in reference to its soccer team. This was how ill-informed she was. And you know, she had to travel overland from Sao Paulo, Brazil, all the way up through South and Central America. Through Ciudad Juarez, which is one of the most violent cities in Mexico, to make it to the land border. So it's, you know, and she had no idea when they drove her to the detention facility. You know, she thought that they were just taking her into America, and then suddenly she's, you know, going behind these chain link fences with razor wire on the top, and it took her months and months to get her situation resolved.
Well, especially in light of what is going on, the migrant crisis now in Europe, you know, people from the Middle East, North Africa, and Central Africa. There are a lot of people in the U.S. who are advocating for taking on more asylum seekers, especially those fleeing Syria. What are the odds that this process would get straightened out in order to handle an influx of, you know, some people are saying as much as 20,000 Syrian refugees?
Well, if we took 20,000 Syrian refugees and they came through, you know, UNHCR, the United Nations High Commission on Refugees, they wouldn't end up in these detention facilities. I mean, just geography protects us from having to deal with the questions that Europe is facing right now. But if we were in Europe's position and Syrians could very easily reach our land borders, it's worth noting that we would not have some, you know, open arms policy or be putting them, you know, in nice facilities. They would be going into detention camps. It would be exactly what happened when we saw the flood of, you know, children immigrants in particular in the summer of 2014. You know, they get put in detention facilities. That's what happens to you if you show up at a land border in America asking for asylum.
Well, much has been made of private prisons possibly profiting off of the high incarceration rates in the U.S. You make the point that many of these immigration detention facilities are run by for-profit companies. What does that mean for ethical questions of retaining asylum seekers for as much as, you know, a couple of years at a cost of $2 billion a year?
Well, it's hard to draw, you know, a hard linkage between these two, but there's a lot of speculation that there is not an incentive to, you know, expedite the processing of a lot of these folks. You know, the private prison industry has a very strong lobby, and there's a lot of question about whether or not their interest in the issue of immigration detention are influencing our policy.
Well, Tom, thank you very much for going through this with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Tom Peter, he's a journalist who's currently based in Turkey. He wrote about the plight of asylum seekers in the U.S., and there's a link to read his article. It's called They Treat You Like an Inmate, and it appeared in Politico. Again, a link at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When on vacation or in an unfamiliar part of the state and looking to grab a bite, you might look up restaurant reviews on Yelp. That's a popular app for user-generated reviews of food or dentists or contractors, and now penitentiaries. Inmates in several prisons across the country are describing and rating their experiences in jail. It's not as if convicted felons have a choice of where they'd like to land, but inmates are taking advantage of one of few platforms that allow their free and transparent expression with the outside world. Word of Mouth producer Megan Tan wanted to find out more, so she spoke with Beth Schwartzipfel. She's a staff writer for the Marshall Project, who's been writing about prisoners writing on Yelp.
A lot of the reviews you'll see online are just sort of jokey and snarky.
Some of them were like this. Listen, I learned a lot at summer camp as a child, but if you really want to learn skills you can use, you need to go to jail. I'll explain. Summer camp, you learn how to tie a knot. Jail, you learn how to, using a razor, toothbrush, and a lighter, you can make a weapon and either defend yourself or shank a snitch. Winner. Jail.
But sort of mixed in among those, you'll find these really raw reviews by people who are coming home from prison or jail and who just sort of let loose this stream of information about what they experienced.
Or you read some like this. I got to sleep in a paper gown on a concrete slab with no cushions or sheets or anything I could use to either kill myself or get comfortable. It smells like death in there, and it's cold.
And the striking thing about things like this are that, you know, they're not helpful in the same way that a user review is usually helpful. Most of us, if we're going to check a site like that, it's because we're thinking of going to a particular restaurant and we want to know what people thought of it, or we're thinking of going to a particular town and we want to know, like, where to eat or where to stay. People don't typically plan to go to jail, so it's not like someone's going to log on to Yelp and say, oh, good, I'm glad I got that tip about how to get the best food at that prison. I'll make sure to check Yelp next time before I go to prison.
Which is true. When I was looking at different jail reviews on Yelp, it's jarring to read a review like, in my cell itself, I was pleased to find feces on my floor, peeling walls, windows that only let in humidity, and a curious amount of generic graffiti on my ceiling, which appeared to have been written with shoe polish. And then to see a button next to it that says, funny, helpful, and then to also see how many people clicked them. Beth herself says that maybe Yelp isn't the best form of this kind of expression, but it's an accessible platform for bridging a gap.
And I think the main thing that it will do is further advance the sense that, you know, it's not really us and them. Despite how many people are in prison, it's really concentrated in, you know, urban areas, particular communities. And so other communities can kind of convince themselves, oh, we don't know anybody in jail or prison. As long as you sort of do the right thing, you'll never have to come into contact with that system. And I think more and more sites like Yelp are revealing that to be a lie. You know, the more we see just how many people are tangled up in the system, I think the more we become aware of how big and overwhelming it is.
And there are people who are indirectly connected to the criminal justice system that use it. Beth says that some family members use Yelp and Google reviews as a way to reach out to other families, to tell them what to expect when they go to visit, what rules there are, and how much time it takes to get processed. Because visiting someone in prison is harder than most people think. For each prison, the visiting rules are different, and if families don't come equipped to get through the process, they could be rejected at the door.
Yeah, I've heard so many terrible stories of families being turned away, you know, driving hours to see a loved one and then not having the proper ID, or maybe their driver's license expired, you know, or maybe they're wearing the wrong shoes and they can't see their loved one. So in that case, I think it really is people aiming to be helpful.
In addition to being helpful to family members who are visiting their loved ones in jail, writing a Yelp review has also helped previous inmates emotionally.
I guess I underestimated the extent to which these kinds of things are therapeutic for people. You know, that a lot of people told me that it made them feel better to just put it out there. Even if nobody ever reads it, I think that for a lot of people, it helps them to just write down what they've been through. One woman just told me that directly. I wrote a review of jail on Yelp because I couldn't afford a therapist.
With online reviews of Yelp being easily accessible to the public, they have a potential to serve as transparent testimonies to the criminal justice system in the same way that The Jungle by Upton Sinclair served the meat industry. And therefore, they could instigate some capacity of reform. But there's no way to verify that these reviews are true, or even being written by people who went to prison. And even if there was proof that these people writing these reviews were in fact abused in the prison system, Beth says it probably wouldn't do any good.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, this isn't the first or even the thousandth place or time that people have pointed out, you know, countless things that are really terrible about our criminal justice system. You know, this kind of abuses and inhumane treatment is now routinely on the front page of the New York Times and in, you know, major magazines and the Washington Post. And, you know, it would be nice to see some change result from that. But I don't know. It doesn't, nobody seems to be in a rush to make any real reform.
It's hard to know what exactly needs to happen to instigate reform in the criminal justice system. And it's hard to know if the people who are leaving reviews are being genuine. But I think reading enough of them, you get a feeling that there are raw bits of people's diaries online that reveal some truth about a system that often feels far away. So in a way, Yelp is fulfilling the platform that it was meant to be, a safe place for people to share their experiences online and make a service place more transparent.
Word of Mouth producer Megan Tan there speaking with Beth Schwartzipfel from the Marshall Project. That's a nonprofit organization covering America's justice system.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. There's no telling which candidates will be left standing after the 2016 presidential primary season. We do know that there won't be so many, and that by the time Republicans and Democrats convene next July, their respective candidates will have been chosen. It didn't always work that way. Party conventions used to be consequential, with candidates decided there. Backroom deals were made. There was real drama on the convention floor and genuine surprises on stage. Back in 1968, Democrats heading to Chicago were divided. That year, ABC ranked third out of three networks and did the unthinkable. Instead of providing wall-to-wall coverage like CBS and NBC, they hired two political commentators to debate the day's events, the conservative William F. Buckley and the liberal Gore Vidal. Our next guest says that television commentary has gone downhill ever since. Robert Gordon is producer and director, along with Morgan Neville, of the new documentary Best of Enemies, which tells the story of the Buckley-Vidal debates, an adapted introduction to his forthcoming book, Buckley versus Vidal, the historic 1968 ABC News debates, appeared in Politico. Robert Gordon, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia. Thanks for having me on and up in New Hampshire.
Well, you know, it's such an interesting story, and this was kind of a wild stab for ABC. What was behind this, as they called it, unconventional convention coverage?
Well, for ABC, they were third out of three networks. They would have been fourth, but there were only three. They were that far behind the other two. And this was really economically driven for them. They needed the income from their primetime shows like The Flying Nun and Batman and those kind of things, Land of the Giants. So they didn't want to go gavel to gavel like had become the journalistic standard. And many news outlets made fun of them for forsaking their journalistic integrity. Part of the way they were going to make up for this lack of in-depth coverage was getting commentators on at night to give commentary on what had happened during the day at the Republican and Democratic national conventions. They approached William Buckley, who was the leading light in reforming the conservative movement at the time, and asked him to participate. And this was going to be the biggest audience he would have had yet on national TV. So he accepted, and they said, who do you want to debate? And he named a number of his liberal friends, probably including Norman Mailer. And they said, who do you not want to debate? And his very interesting reply was, well, on principle, I wouldn't debate a communist. And other than that, the only one I can think of is Gore Vidal. And I strongly suspect that ABC's next call was to Gore Vidal.
So they knew they were setting up a fight.
They thought they were going to get some friction. What they didn't realize was that they would get the whole explosion of the culture wars that we live in today you know, neatly packaged in these two guys going head to head.
And you said Buckley was somewhat motivated anyway by trying to rebrand conservatives. He was trying to distance them from, what did he call them, the kooks and anti-Semites. What was behind it for Vidal? Why did he participate?
Well, Vidal had a policy of never saying no to sex or appearing on television. So that's part of what motivated him. And, you know, he had run for political office on the Kennedy ticket in 1960. He considered himself, you know, potentially presidential material, which was something I came to understand in the making of this film and was really shocking to me to realize. But Vidal was a very progressive thinker and also recognized the opportunity of this national audience. And it's important to keep in mind that in 1968, the audience was not predetermined. In other words, Fox now preaches to the Fox audience. MSNBC preaches to the MSNBC audience. Each preaches to its choir. When we were a nation of only three networks, you could change people's minds. So these guys were seizing the opportunity to help recruit people to their way of thinking.
Well, in 1968, Chicago was also remembered for a very different clash. Mayor Daley, Chicago police and National Guard cracking down very hard on protesters. Even Dan Rather, Mike Wallace, other reporters were roughed up while at the convention. How did that play out in these nightly recaps with Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley?
Well, they did Miami first, and it was actually Miami Beach. Gore, when he gets to Chicago, he called it a sandbar with a drawbridge. So it had been this very distant, controlled place, even though there was a riot in Miami Beach, which we found footage of. You know, at that time, the Democratic Party was the party of war. The Vietnam War was their war. And protesters were descending there to say, you know, get us out of Vietnam. We're not going to fight this war. Johnson was not going to run. It had gotten more than chaos to the point where it was practically civil war. There was actual, you know, legitimate discussion of anticipating a civil war in the U.S. over Vietnam. And that August in 68 in Chicago is probably the nearest we came. And Buckley and Vidal, by the time of Chicago, are really reflecting the tensions in the Chicago street and in the country. They both embody the polarized positions.
We're speaking with Robert Gordon. He is a producer and director, along with Morgan Neville, of a new documentary. It's called Best of Enemies, which tells the story of these debates and distinguishes them from the bombastic political debates on television of today. Well, let's hear just a little bit of the penultimate debate between the two. This is where things got heated.
As far as I'm concerned, the only sort of pro or crypto Nazi I can think of is yourself. Failing that, I would only say that we can't have.
Now, listen, you queer. Stop calling me a crypto Nazi.
Let's stop calling names.
I'll slap you in your goddamn face, and you'll stay plastered.
Gentlemen, let's go.
Okay, there they go. In their very patrician accents, I might add, calling each other crypto Nazi and queer. Not really civil political discourse, but what was it?
Well, when we were beginning this film, one of the questions we kept asking ourselves was, you know, when did civil discourse become uncivil? And in essence, we knew this film was about these two guys, William F. Buckley Jr. and Gore Vidal. And the research led us to understand that it was also about ABC and about networks and about ratings, because these guys were given 15 minutes uninterrupted each night of the conventions for their contretemps. And it's a much slower burn than we're accustomed to now. And people tuned in because this was a fight that built. You know, ABC was surprised that it was a success. They were trying to steer these guys back onto the subject at hand. But for these two men, the subject was each other. And over time, what has happened is that networks took away the notion of shouting sells. You know, shouting gets ratings. And we live in a world now where commercials are punctuated by 4 minutes of shouting. That's political discourse on TV as we know it. And I think it can be traced to that incident. And the build is forgotten. The build is where the content was, and the content has been forgotten, and all we have is the shouting.
Well, we had two public intellectuals duking it out on television. And your lament is that it is not something that we're likely to see today, despite having hundreds of channels of content. But why not? I mean, there are plenty of pundits debating issues of the moment on television.
Well, I don't know. I tune in and hear talking points from party shills. Sometimes I hear pundits. Sometimes there are a few environments left, but not many. We don't hear it in the public discourse the way we used to on, say, Dick Cavett or even Johnny Carson, in a way. These shows weren't advertisements for the newest release of whatever. And I have a little hope, you know, that with all these channels, some network that's just like all the other networks will be failing and say, wow, we can't attract the audience everyone else is attracting. What audience out there is underserved? And that perhaps someone would say, what if we try to create an environment that recruits what we used to call the public intellectual, someone now in a university or a think tank who is engaging to the public. That's what we forget, the humor of the public intellectual, who's not a party shill. We finished this film in January of this year, and we've had it on the road at film festivals for, you know, 8 or so months. And I can say, based on my encounter with now thousands of people, that Americans are hungry for nuance and are hungry for actual content. You know, networks are afraid to break the mold. That one, I hope, will finally take the chance and we will be able to see original thought return to television.
Well, Robert Gordon, a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you. And I can't wait to see the film.
Thanks for having me on.
Robert Gordon, his producer and director, along with Morgan Neville, of the new documentary Best of Enemies, which tells the story of the Buckley-Vidal debates, an adapted introduction to his forthcoming book, Buckley versus Vidal, the historic 1968 ABC News debates, appeared in Politico. You'll find a link to read it for yourself and more on the documentary and the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
What happened to Sharon? Wasn't it a provocative act to pull down an American flag and put up a Viet Cong flag, even if you disagree with what the United States is doing?
It is not a provocative act. You have every right in this country to take any position you want to take because we are guaranteed freedom of speech. We've just listened to a rather grotesque example.
Now, let's not talk at the same time, Mr. Buckley.
Certain acts that are lawful are nevertheless provocative. I'll give you an example. George Lincoln Rockwell.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. This weekend, Portsmouth hosts the 15th annual New Hampshire Film Festival, featuring films made in the Granite State or by filmmakers from the area. Now, before the break, we heard about one of the films in the program, Best of Enemies. That's about the 1968 Buckley-Vidal debates. Joining us with a preview of some of the other films and events coming to the weekend festival is Nicole Golovsky, programming director for the 2015 New Hampshire Film Festival, which begins today, October 15th, and goes through Sunday. Nicole, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me, Virginia.
Well, Nicole, it sounds like a big festival coming up this weekend. Give me the headlines.
So the New Hampshire Film Festival is going to feature 110 films in 4 days across 4 venues. We have 4 industry panels that are all going to be fascinating and 5 parties that will provide many, many networking experiences, laughter, and a chance to really engage and talk about everything that you've seen over the weekend.
So we heard a little bit about the documentary on William F. Buckley and Gore Vidal's famous television appearances. What are some of the other films, shorts, documentaries? What's the range?
Yeah, absolutely. We have quite a few different things going on. We obviously have our feature narrative films that are pretty much the most popular, but what we love to do is to bring documentaries and short films and have an exhibition platform for those films as well. So we're really excited to have those. There's 9 short blocks that play Friday through Sunday, and then in the New Hampshire block alone today, that will be playing throughout the day at the Music Hall and the Music Hall Loft. We have 6 short blocks of films that hail from the Granite State.
So when you say New Hampshire-based films, what are you talking about? Like somebody on the crew, somebody, some filmmaker is involved who's from New Hampshire? Or how deep does that go?
Yeah, so we gauge our New Hampshire affiliation with films that are created by filmmakers. It's either key cast, so one of the lead actors is from New Hampshire, or one of the key crew, so that's the director, the lead producer, the cinematographer. Any of those can qualify it as a New Hampshire-affiliated film, or if the film is filmed in New Hampshire. So a few L.A. films that the entire film was filmed here in New Hampshire, those qualify as well.
So of these feature narrative films, the ones we think of as the movies, what are some of the bigger films featured in the festival that you're excited about?
Well, it's really hard to choose, but if we start with today, I'm very, very excited for both Manglehorn and Bob in the Trees. There are 2 features that are highlighting New Hampshire night. Manglehorn will have producer Lisa Muscat in attendance, and that's a film by David Gordon Green starring Al Pacino and Holly Hunter. Bob in the Trees had a great, great run at Sundance this year and also has won awards all over the world, including the Karlovy International Film Festival, but it stars 2 local actors, Matt Gallagher, who's the head brewer at the Portsmouth Brewery, and Bob Tarasuk, who is his real-life father-in-law. And it's just a really interesting look at the logging industry in New England, but it's a narrative. And it has some really great cinematography and really, really great standout performances by 2 of the leads.
Let's hear just a clip from that film, Bob in the Trees.
Good job.
Whose business is this?
You always say that.
Who owns this business, man?
You do. Congratulations. You're the owner of a $25,000 ant farm. Way to go.
Let me go back to the film that you mentioned earlier, Al Pacino in a new film called Manglehorn. Tell us a little bit about the film.
Well, that film is one of the newest from David Gordon Green. What's really interesting about David Gordon Green is that no 2 films of his are alike. He really pushes the boundaries in each one. Manglehorn is a bit of a magical love story and a story about family ties, and it's one of Al Pacino's most breakout performances in years. The critics really liked it, and we're so excited to bring it here, especially from a New Hampshire native producer.
Okay, let's hear just a clip from that.
I'm asking for help, Dad.
Help? What kind of help? I got a pull-out sofa in the house. You want that? You want to stay here?
I don't want your sofa. You know what I want? It would be great if you could be a father.
What is that?
How about that? Could be okay, Jacob. You know, it's gonna be good, Jacob. It's gonna be okay. It's gonna be okay.
Is that what being a dad is?
Yeah.
It's okay?
Yeah.
Okay, it's okay. It's okay.
That was a clip from Manglehorn starring Al Pacino and produced by New Hampshire's own Lisa Muscat. And this is a point worth mentioning. The New Hampshire Film Festival is very female-friendly this year.
Absolutely. So there's only 7% female filmmakers right now in the U.S. In our program alone, we have about 25% of our films are directed by females, which is extraordinarily exciting to see just these films rising above and women that are a lot of times facing an uphill battle to be able to break through and break through with such incredible content and talent.
So let's get to the opening night feature. This is a film called Experimenter, starring Peter Sarsgaard, about some very famous social psychological experiments, the Stanley Milgram experiments. What's the deal?
Right, so it's from director Michael Almereyda, who is consistently very beautiful and very cerebral. So it's going to see this story brought to life in a different way than just kind of a point-by-point biopic on the Stanley Milgram life and experiments that he conducted. The experiments themselves are really fascinating. It's about pushing humans to, at what point do we refuse authority? And under what circumstances do normal people say no if urged to do something? And especially in the context of hurting another individual. It is very heavy and obviously very deep, but the findings of the experiments were very, very shocking. But also when you look at Stanley Milgram under the same kind of microscope and what pushed him to push these people into these experiments is what the film really explores.
Well, let's hear a clip. This is from the film The Experimenters.
Rug, pillow, hair, grass. Incorrect. 165 volts strong shock.
Let me out of here. I will not be part of the experiment anymore.
He says he's not going to go on. Please continue.
He says he doesn't want to go on.
We must continue.
We're talking with Nicole Golovsky. She's program director of the 2015 New Hampshire Film Festival, which is taking place this weekend. We're getting a couple of highlights. Now, Nicole, you mentioned a number of films in the shorts program. Any up-and-comers that we should be watching out for?
Our short documentaries are incredible. There's some that are going to make you just drop your jaw. Body Team 12 from David Darg is an alumni filmmaker. He did Sun City Picture House in 2011, and he's an up-and-coming documentarian that you're definitely going to want to look out for. We also have Spear Hunter, which is a just wacky short documentary that's about this guy that has declared himself the greatest spear hunter in the world. The documentary has a little bit of a Wes Anderson feel to it as far as how it's filmed, and it's really interesting and fun to see truth brought to light with such creativity. That's from director Adam Rothman, who used to be the executive director of the IFF Boston Film Festival.
The International Film Festival. So it's not just for film fans, but also filmmakers. What are some of the panels that you've got coming up over this weekend?
Yeah, the biggest one that I think is the most important to hit for filmmakers is the distribution panel. This features industry insiders from IFC Films, A24, Vimeo, Oscilloscope Laboratories, Factory 25, all these places that everybody wants to know, well, once you've made it, where does it go? How do you sell it? What happens? What are you looking for? How do I even get to know these people? And we bring them here to talk to filmmakers and to talk to the general public that's interested in the process, but also in the local filmmakers especially that are interested to getting into the bigger game on what the game plan should be for their film, how to sell and how to build relationships with those big distributors.
Your festival, the New Hampshire Film Festival, has really grown over the years, and several films that were at last year's festival were also nominated for Oscars. Nicole, did you ever think this was going to get so big?
Well, it's what we always hope. What's been amazing is just the relationships. I think that's what happens when you've been around for 15 years, that you see someone from the first time they're writing a script in our screenplay competition to then them making a short film to now they're making feature films that get into Sundance, and then they make feature films that get nominated for Academy Awards. We've built relationships over those 15 years, and we've also built really strong relationships with people in the industry, and it just kind of started naturally happening. We didn't have to really coax it too much to grow, or we just had a wonderful foundation, a wonderful audience that supports the arts, and then we kind of let the relationships take us where we needed to go. So we're absolutely thrilled. We hope to have a few more Oscar contenders in our program this year.
Well, Nicole, it sounds like an ambitious and amazing program. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Absolutely.
Nicole Golovsky, she's programming director of the 2015 New Hampshire Film Festival. It starts today, October 15th, and runs until Sunday. You can find much more information on the festival, the schedule, and tickets at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. You can subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please write a review or tell a friend. It really helps others to find us more easily and continues our mission to spread things around via word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.